Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Support for this podcast is provided by Subchuck Law. Revolution Recap thanks Subchuck Law for their support of our show, local independent media, and their mission of bringing unbiased truth. Revolution Recap would also like to thank Six Point Builders for their support. Six Point Builders are builders of fine custom homes in the Boston metropolitan area.
Another episode of Revolution Recap, part of the Believe Network. We're coming at you after the New England Revolution started the playoffs with a very disappointing 3-1 loss at Philadelphia that saw Captain Carles Hill leave the match injured in the first half and left the Revs one loss from elimination. I'm Sean Donahue, joined today by Andy Judd from Revolution Nation. Andy, how's it going?
It's going okay. It would certainly be better if the Revs had performed a little better last night, but good. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I think, you know, 19 or so minutes in, it was looking okay for the Revs. They had some chances. They were playing pretty well. And I think we thought we might have a different tone of this episode today, but everything collapsed pretty quickly.
Yeah, it all came on at once. Things were looking good. Things were looking up. And then, you know, kind of over the span of maybe 10, 20 minutes, everything kind of fell apart.
Yeah, I don't think the first half could have gone much worse. Before we jump into it, I want to talk about our sponsor, BetOnline. The last of the major pro sports leagues kicks off this week, and BetOnline is your top spot for all your NBA action this season. With MLB postseason, NFL, college football, MLS postseason, and NHL in full swing, BetOnline is your number one source for wagering news, odds, trends, and predictions. Get everything NBA at your fingertips with both desktop and mobile access for every sport, anytime. Head to BetOnline today and get in on the action. Don't forget to use promo code BELIEVE, that's B-L-E-A-V, to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, where the game starts. Let's get right into our key takeaways, which are brought to you by our friends at the Rebellion Supporters Group. Be sure to check them out on Twitter at AnyRebellion and on their website at AnyRebellion.org. Andy, this game played out like a lot of recent Revs games, but what was your takeaway from it?
So I'll start my takeaway with a question, and is that, are we living in a simulation? Is time a flat circle? If you might recall, on May 20th, you and I got together to record a podcast after the Revs played away on the road in Philly, a game in which Carles Hill left early in the first half with an injury. The Revs looked listless after that. They conceded three goals, one of which was a Gazdag penalty. And, fast forward to last night, it's very much the same story. There are some small differences, and my key takeaway will kind of stem from those. Back in May, the Revs had zero shots on goal. That was a very bad game. We came onto this podcast and talked about, you know, should we be hitting the panic button? You know, Carles Hill was injured. I think, if I remember correctly, Brandon Bye and Matt Polster also left that game with injuries. So there was a lot of panic happening then. There's a lot of panic happening now. The stakes are higher, of course, in this game. But another key difference between last night and the game in May was the Revs had six shots on goal and they scored a goal. And if you look at the lineups between that game in May and the game last night, one big difference, of course, is that Gustavo Bow is available and was in the starting lineup, and he is the one that scores the goal. You know, I don't think that necessarily he's a contributor to the fact that the Revs, you know, increased their shots on goal from 0 to 6 necessarily. But I think you have to say that he's had a pretty positive impact since he's been back from injury. And so he's going to be absolutely crucial to what the Revs can do going forward, if indeed they can get more than one game out of the rest of this season, which, you know, given the way the Revs played last night, I'm not sure that's a realistic expectation. But you know, if Carlos is going to be injured and out for any amount of time, it's certainly nice to have Bo as someone who can create a bit of magic kind of out of nothing, which is, I think, maybe what the Revs would need.
Well, you're right that we can't give all the credit to him for the 6 shots on target, but he is responsible for 3 of those shots on target, so you can give half the credit to him, right?
That's right, yeah, 50%.
But anyways, I completely agree with everything you said there. I don't know about you, but when I saw Carles Hill go out injured, I knew this game was over. The Revs were already down a goal in Philadelphia. It was a tough place to play in general. I didn't see any scenario where the Revolution won this match down 1-0 without Carles Hill. Were you in the same boat as me?
Yeah, I mean, so based upon the playoff format, right, you kind of have to go into this understanding that the Revs knew they knew what the stakes were, right? They wanted to win this game, obviously. But, you know, giving up an early goal in a place that's tough to play, where you've traditionally had almost no success, you know, the calculus is there, and the writing kind of seemed to be on the wall especially after that second goal. But, I didn't have a ton of confidence that this game was going to change dramatically after the Revs went down.
And, you know, the flip side of your kind of comment about what the Revs have now that they didn't have in May when that result happened is what they had in May that they don't have now, and that was Georgi Petrovic in goal. And I think, you know, you talk about the mistake from Jacob Jackson. I don't want to hit Jacob Jackson too hard. He's a young goalkeeper. I think he was put in a very difficult situation by Clint Pied to come in with a couple games left in the regular season and take over that starting role with, you know, no first team experience and then go in and start these playoff games. So, you know, he made a mistake in this game. He made a mistake last week. It's not shocking that a young goalkeeper makes these mistakes. It's just extremely amplified when you're playing in such high stake matchups. And I think, you know, Greg might've mentioned this a few podcasts ago, but reminded me back to when we had Jay Heaps on the podcast, and he was talking about Matt Turner, and he said towards the end of his tenure, you know, he wanted to play Matt Turner. He thought he was ready, but he didn't want to put him in the situation where the team was struggling so much and kind of kill his confidence and lead to a bad situation. And I think Jacob Jackson's been put in a pretty bad situation for the Revolution with where they're at mentally and with how they've been playing. And it's just kind of unfortunate that that's played out this way. But, you know, when you talk about, you know, the Revs are better off now than they were without Carlos Hill because they have Gustavo Bow. But at the same time, defensively, I think they're a lot worse off now because they lost the best goalkeeper in the league. And unfortunately, the attempt to replace him with Vasilik didn't work out. And, you know, Jacob Jackson might be a very good keeper for the Revs in the future. But as we've seen recently, there's been, you know, mistakes from him that have been very costly for the Revolution. So I think on the flip side of saying, you know, Bo's helping out, and he certainly is, and that makes the offense a little bit more threatening even without Gustavo Bow. Without Carlos Hill, rather. Defensively, I think the Revolution are in a much worse place than they were when they played Philadelphia back in May, now that they don't have Petrovic.
Yeah, I completely agree. Petrovic kind of papered over a lot of the cracks in the Revs' defense. And, you know, that's something that a great goalkeeper is able to do. And you know, the Revs had a very good goalkeeper in Georgi Petrovic. And the switch from him has been, you know, maybe a little rocky. You know, I don't want to hammer Jacob Jackson too hard. Like, I think he's a talented young goalkeeper. We've seen a lot of, I've seen a lot of skill in terms of his ability to keep the ball out of the net in terms of saves and diving saves and that sort of thing. So, you know, I want to give him some credit for those attributes. But it hasn't been enough, you know, quite to paper over the cracks in the Revs defense. And, you know, this game and the last one, both games, he comes out of his goal kind of, you know, unnecessarily. You know, it has some maybe poor positional awareness and concedes a penalty kick in last night's game and should have conceded the penalty kick in the last game if they hadn't also scored on that play. So, you know, we can chalk it up to him being, you know, young and kind of being thrust into, you know, a tough spot. But he certainly hasn't helped the Revs out in that regard over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and just kind of jumping right into questions, because I think this leads to it, is Rich on Twitter said, who should the Revs start in goal for the next game?
You know, that's a really tough question, because on the one hand, like, you know, the part of me wants to go back to, you know, kind of the known safe veteran presence that is Earl Edwards. Because, you know, we know what we're going to get from him. And I honestly think that from what I've seen, Jacob Jackson might be a better shot stopper in terms of his ability to make those saves. But, you know, he has more experience, and therefore I think he might be, you know, a little more patient in certain situations, and he might have a little bit better positional awareness. And in these high stakes games, that's kind of what you want. But at the same time, I do think you take a little bit of a hit in terms of the ability to keep the ball out of the back of the net that you get with Jackson. And then, of course, we have Vanslyk, who I think was on the bench in this last game, but we haven't seen him, and we signed him, you know, months ago, who is a veteran goalkeeper who, you know, in theory, from what I've seen of his tape, is a good shot stopper as well. You know, so he should be the obvious choice. It's just he hasn't been fit enough to even get a start, and sometimes not even fit enough to get on the bench. So I don't know what you do with that. So it's a tough decision, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, didn't Vasilik this last week post like something on Instagram or something of him like being fit or something, of him working out and trying to imply that like he was in good shape, which is interesting. But you know, I think this is a really, really tough question for the reasons you said. But also, you know, I'm sure Clint is not looking to next season because he might not be here next season. But I do think that kind of factors into the equation here, right? If you think Jacob Jackson is your goalkeeper next season, do you want to bench him here and crush his confidence and then deal with that next year? You know, or you know, if he's not the keeper next season and you don't think he's going to be your starter next year, I'd be more inclined to start Edwards this game. I think he is the safer option. You know, he's got the experience. I don't think he's as good a shot stopper as Jacob Jackson, but I also don't think he's as likely to make the mistakes that Jacob Jackson's been making. And again, I think over time, Jacob Jackson won't make those mistakes, but it's tough to be kind of gaining that experience in the playoffs when the Revs are in an elimination game. So my kind of thought process is, you know, if Jacob Jackson, if you don't think he's your goalkeeper of next year, I'd probably go to Earl Edwards in this game. If you do think Jacob Jackson is your goalkeeper of next year, I think I'd, you know, keep playing him just because I think it would be such a crushing blow to his long-term confidence to bench him for this one. And I'm also not convinced that regardless of who you put in goal in this game is necessarily going to make a difference on whether or not the Revs advance, especially if Carlos Heel's not healthy. We'll get into that later. But so I think that's a very, very tough question. I could lean either way on this one. Yeah, like you said, in the ideal world, Vasilik would be healthy, fit, and 100%, and he'd be your goalkeeper. But even if he is now, I don't know if you put him in for his first game in this situation either. So it's a really tough question. In some ways, it's a problem that Clint Pea has created for himself by benching Earl Edwards late in the season for Jacob Jackson, you know, without much time to figure things out. But I don't know what happens in this game.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, if they think Jackson's the goalkeeper of the future, then they should play him. If they don't think he's the goalkeeper of the future, they shouldn't play him. And the problem with that from the Revs' perspective is I don't think they know if he's the goalkeeper of the future because they haven't given him a whole lot of,
right,
you know, an opportunity to show that. So it's really, you know, they're testing him out now, you know, and they have been over the last three games. And it's a maybe too high of a stakes situation to just try something out and see if he's got what it takes. You know, if it works, right, it really works, and then you feel really confident about it. But it's not a great situation to put a young goalkeeper in, especially against a great team like Philly and on the road and in the playoffs. So, you know, I could absolutely see the Revs going with Jackson next year. I think he's a viable option in goal, but, you know, we don't have a lot of sample size on how he's looked just over the course of the season to know if that's, you know, the cut and dry choice.
Yeah, it's too bad earlier in the year when, you know, Pedrick was gone, or when there were opportunities to put in another goalkeeper, that it was always Earl Edwards, and they didn't give Jacob Jackson a chance sooner this season to see what they had, because this really is a rough time to be doing that. The one thing I will add is that it was interesting. We talked about it last week at the supporters summit, that it seemed like Brian Bilello was saying Kevin Hitchcock had a lot of say in who, you know, started week to week based on his recommendation. And I do trust him, certainly over anyone else in this organization, to pick who the goalkeeper is. So I'm sure whoever starts this week, it will be he'll be heavily involved in the decision. If I were to gamble and bet on who was going to start this week, I'd say they stick with Jackson. But it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out, and I could see them going either way.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, if the Revs are in the situation, which is the situation I'm in, which is where we don't really know who is going to be the best situation for next year, I think they just stand pat and go with Jackson. I think that's probably what they'll do.
And switching out of questions quickly, what did you think of the lineup decisions for this game? It was the exact same lineup we saw as the final regular season game, except for Kay started over Tommy McNamara. And then after the match, we learned that it sounds like McNamara picked up some injury. So it sounded like he might have started otherwise. But me personally, I was not surprised to see no changes. But were you surprised by anything in that lineup?
No, I wasn't surprised by anything. I think, you know, it was a lineup that, you know, with the exception, of course, of McNamara being swapped out, had performed really well last week. And to be honest, it looked, as the game started here, I think you mentioned it kind of at the top of the show, like for the first, you know, 10, 20 minutes, the Revs, I thought, looked like the better team. And you know, I think the lineup that they put out there had a lot to do with that. And of course, things rapidly fell apart after that. But, you know, I think making, you know, or going with a similar lineup to the one that worked against this same team, you know, a week ago, I think that's a fine play.
And Clint Pia did say that with the 10 days off between now and the next game, which is good news for the Revolution with a lot of guys that now need to recover, that Kessler and McNamara should be more fit. So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw the two of them go back into the lineup next week. Kessler was on the bench for this game after not being on the bench for the final regular season game. I still think he must have had some sort of setback for that to have happened. I know they said it was very precautionary and nothing to do with any injury, but I would not be surprised to see the two of them, assuming everything goes well this week, back in the starting lineup next week.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, right, given health, right, things could change, and I still think that, you know, Kessler's probably at this point, you know, a better bet to start as center back than Andrew Farrell is. And I love Andrew Farrell, but, you know, we've seen the pairing between Romney and Kessler work pretty well. So I still think that's your best center back pair. And, you know, Tommy McNamara looked pretty good last week in the role that he played. So I could see, you know, I could see making the swap back to that as well. But, you know, that one's a little more up in the air, I think, in terms of quality.
Yeah, and Kay was subbed out at halftime, which I don't think he had a great performance, but I think this was more about needing to switch stuff up than necessarily his performance. We'll see how that plays out. Mike Kennedy on Twitter says, this result feels more like the Revs lost it versus Philly winning it. Do you guys agree?
I guess you could say that. I mean, so the way it played out from just a pure narrative standpoint for me, right, was the Revs look good to start the game. You know, they hit the crossbar. They have a chance that, honestly, that Bo should probably put away. I don't know what happens on it. It's like it's a cross that comes kind of over him, and he misses it. I don't know if it's just too far away from the angle on TV, or if he doesn't quite see it coming until it's too late, or what it was. But, you know, the Revs had a few very strong chances in the opening go of it, and then, you know, Jacob Jackson kind of clatters into, you know, a Union attacker and concedes a penalty, and things start to shift, right, from an emotional standpoint, from a narrative standpoint, and so that's a mistake, right, that the Revs made, where, you know, things took a turn, and from then on, basically, right, Carlos Heel, of course, leaves the game immediately following that penalty kick. And from then on, it just feels like the Revs don't have they don't have an identity. They don't have a plan on how to get themselves back into it. And they kind of, you know, are reeling for a little while. And of course they concede two more goals in the first half. And, you know, so from that perspective, I think you could say that, you know, if it takes is one mistake to kind of unravel the team, then yeah, it's on the Revs to figure out how to be able to come back from something like that.
Yeah, I sort of agree with this comment as well. I think Philly certainly outplayed the Revs, but the way the Revs conceded the goals, it did feel like a lot of they're doing undoing themselves, right? It was the penalty they gave up. It was the kind of the tough communication between Romney and Jackson on that play that put them both in a tough spot. Although that play even started before that, where I think DeJuan Jones didn't do a good job tracking his runner to allow that cross to get off so easily. So there was a lot of mistakes on that play, and then of course there was a free kick where Noel Buck didn't track his runner, and maybe it just wasn't a good job of holding the offside line or whatever. But it was a lot of self-inflicted wounds by the Revs. If you want to give Philly credit for injuring Carles Hill and taking him out of the game to help win it, they certainly did that. But I do think there's certainly logic to Mike's comment here. But at the same time, even without the Revs' error, I would say Philly outplayed the Revs in this one. So it can kind of go both ways with that comment.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't want to take anything away from Philly. They certainly came out and looked like a team that, was ready to play and ready to win. And, despite the fact that the Revs kind of took it to them in the first 10 or so minutes, they responded to that pretty well, and they kept cool heads. And, they certainly looked like the better team.
Yeah, and Tim on Twitter said, "I hate to boil this down to dumb cliches, but Philly wanted it more. Every ball they were competing for and often winning. Example, on the first goal, DeJuan casually trots over to the ball in the corner and makes a lazy clearance. He's closed down. It's blocked by a defender, forcing Jackson to make a decision. He obviously made the wrong one. After all, this is his third MLS start. As an aside, I hope we don't lose faith in Jackson. He seems like a good shot stopper and is surprisingly good with his feet. He'll get better with experience." More of a comment than a question, but do you agree with all that?
Yeah, I mean, I think... just to talk about the first goal a little bit, I think he mentioned DeJuan Jones kind of lazily, running over and clearing. I don't know that I think that's an effort thing necessarily, right? He gets to the ball, he makes a clearance. It's not like a strong clearance, but I think you can make the argument that he's trying to clear it off the defender out over the touchline. But yeah, I mean, this is, like I said kind of earlier, the mistake by Jackson and then immediately losing Carles Hill, you can feel the energy kind of leave this team. And, so from then on, I think, you see Philly winning a lot of second balls. And I think that there's maybe something to that, right? The Revs are maybe feeling like they got kind of punched in the gut a little bit and they're still kind of trying to figure out how to compete in a game where they are down a goal and down their best player. And so I think Philly maybe spilled some blood in the water, and they I think were more capable of getting to second balls and getting to, challenges and getting stuck in on challenges and stuff like that. So I can absolutely see what they're trying to say here with that comment.
Yeah, I actually blame DeJuan more for the second goal than the first goal, I think, in some ways.
Right.
Because I think he just kind of let his runner pass his runner on to Farrell, where he really should have just kept on him on that one. And that was pretty costly there. Although it wasn't DeJuan's best game defensively by any stretch. Follow us on Twitter says, in a 17-minute stretch, Buck was robbed by the post. Tomas was robbed by a head of clearance. Carles Hill went out injured. Jackson gave up the idiotic PK. There was a near Romney own goal that ended up in the net. Two questions. Which one is the worst one, and which one do you change if you could?
Worst one and which one would I change? So the worst one, I think, is probably the Jackson penalty, right? Because that sets the tone. That gives them, a lead. But in terms of what I would change, I would absolutely take Carles Hill back, right? Like the rest of this game goes down in a whole other way if Carles Hill is on the field. And I don't mean to say that he, would have scored a bunch of goals or anything like that, but I do think that the Revs play differently and can play differently when he's available. So going down a goal, of course, I think is the toughest of those moments. But losing Carles Hill is the one that you really want to undo.
Yeah, I wish I could disagree with you for sake of making this more interesting, but I think the Carles Hill injury is a no-brainer. That's the one you'd absolutely change if you could. And I think the Jackson PK kind of set the tone for the game early on by giving up that early goal. And also, if you were to kind of look at individual moments, that's kind of the one you can most clearly blame on one individual as a mistake, where everything else is kind of a number of guys that share in the blame. So Although, again, unless you want to blame DeJuan Jones for the block clearance.
Right, yeah.
James Downing on Twitter says, does the Carles injury end the Revs' chances entirely, or will they win the home game when they and then actually have a meaningful playoff game in Philly for game three? So I'm assuming this question says, assuming Carles is not back for game two.
Yes. Yeah. So interestingly enough, when I was putting together my thoughts for this this episode, I looked into that game in May against the Philly Union. Carles Hill leaves in the first half of that game, and he's injured. He doesn't make the team for the following game, which was a home game against the Chicago Fire. And that was a game that the Revs didn't lose. And in fact, they would go on to be undefeated over their next seven matches after that loss in Philly. But they did tie that one 3-3. And I think they gave up three goals pretty early to Chicago. And I think you have to say that Chicago is probably not as good a team as Philly is. So, you know, when on Carles Hill, it's absolutely going to be tough. I think having, you know, like I mentioned earlier, having Bo available probably helps mitigate the effects somewhat, but you know, it's going to be tough sledding without Carles if he is in fact to miss the next game.
Yeah, and what's you know, a lot of people were complaining about the 10-day gap between games for the Revolution before the series started. I think no one's complaining now.
Right.
It's interesting. You can't draw too many comparisons to that game in May, but you talk about, you know, the play in Chicago. Carles Hill was not in that game. That game was a week later, right? So Carles Hill did not recover in time for a week later to play that game. He did actually come off the bench in the 62nd minute of that game, so he was partially recovered. But then they played a Wednesday game right after that, so just about the same gap between games as this one, and he played in that game and started. And I think he went 90 minutes or close to it. So
yes, that was a quick recovery for him.
Quick recovery. I don't think we can count on that being the case here. But if you want to take some hope, it's that he did recover from that injury in time to play 90 minutes 10 days later that time. You know, maybe that'll happen here. But you know, hypothetically, if Carles is out for game two, even at home, I have a very difficult time seeing the Revs win that game. And you know, I wouldn't say never. Maybe they do pull it off. Maybe they, you know, have a solid game defensively, win a tight, low-scoring game or something, and bring it back to Philly. But then if Carles is out in Philly for game three as well, there's no scenario I can see where the Revolution advance out of this series with Carles not getting back healthy, even if by some miracle they can win a game two at home without him.
Yeah, I mean, he's pivotal to what the Revs want to do. And, you know, he's obviously the most talented player on the team and oftentimes on the field, depending on who the Revs are playing. But more than that, it's the freedom to play the way they want when he's out there, because he opens up space, right? He attracts, you know, defenders, which opens up space for other players. And, you know, he has the vision to make their system work. And without him on the field, there isn't really anyone who can make those passes that are going to break the lines, that are going to open up the defense. So the Revs kind of did. I think we saw it last night. They relied a little more on trying to put crosses into the box and hope that somebody was available. They didn't do it a ton, but I think more than I'd seen them do in recent weeks.
Right. And if they did have everyone else healthy, right, if Brandon Bye was healthy, if Dylan Barrera was healthy, there's enough other talent on the field where I think the Revs could find other ways to win a game without Carles Hill. But I think with those guys out, there's just too much, you know, missing from this team already. And then to lose Carles on top of that, I think it's just too much for this team. You know, I do think this team is capable of winning games without Carles when everyone else is available. I just think the Revs are missing too many guys to get a win against a Philadelphia team that's very, very talented, one of the best teams in the league, and to do that without Carles. So it's going to be, I don't know, it's going to be interesting to see what they do next week. If Carles isn't healthy, I think everyone has their fingers crossed that Carles is healthy. Best for the Revs and probably best for the league to have him in the matchup.
Right. Yeah, the Revs have been, you know, I think if you look at the arc of the season, right, they've been taking blow after blow in terms of, you know, players leaving or being injured. And then, of course, the coaching situation, you know, between losing Barrero and Bye and Petrovic and the coaching problem, like losing Carles Hill on top of all that. I don't know if the expectation should be that the Revs are able to make that of a series against Philadelphia where they have to play twice on the road.
No. And James on Twitter said, what did you think of the sub of Bobby Wood to bring him on for Carlius when he went on injured?
That felt like they didn't have any other anything else they could think of to do, right? Like they, you know, there is no direct replacement for Carlos Heel on the Revs. There's certainly no one who can match him for talent. And to be honest, there's nobody else on the field who really plays the same kind of way he does. And I think if there was anybody who does, I think you could make an argument that maybe it's Bo and he's already on the field. So, you know, putting him or putting Bobby Wood on the field, you put another striker up top. And then maybe the idea is you give Bo a little bit more freedom to, you know, kind of work himself back and play that attacking midfield role, you know, when the timing suits him and you know, play as a second forward, which, you know, is a position he likes to do in situations where that suits him. So I don't know that I think it's the best possible substitution, but I also don't think that the Revs had better options.
Yeah, I think puts the Revs in kind of a tough spot, right, when Carlos goes down, because there is no like-for-like replacement. There never has been. But I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that sub. I think it was probably the way to go. At the same time, I think if you were starting with Bobby Wood and two strikers with him and Bo, that maybe that's not the midfield that you have behind him. So it's almost a question of do you make two subs that early? And maybe they didn't want to do that, but I think when Ima Boateng came into the game, that the Revs looked a lot more dangerous. So I think if you were, you know, starting this game with two strikers, that, you know, maybe you play with two more true wingers. And I think Noel Buck, I think Noel Buck is a great number eight. I think he's a okay winger. So I just don't know if you were to start the game with two strikers, if that's the midfield you have behind him. But then I don't know if that you want to switch up that midfield at that point when you've already used the sub in the 23rd minute. So it's kind of a no-win situation.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it was never going to go great when Carlos Heel had to leave the game that early, right? So, but yeah, you're right. Like, the Revs were structured in a way to play a certain way, and that way relied on Carlos Heel and having, you know, Gustavo Bo as the forward. And, you know, to switch, you didn't have a great like-for-like substitution, so you're looking to switch things up, and, you know, how many substitutions do you really want to make that early to switch things up, right? You know, it's the 20-something minute, right? So you can't realistically make a ton of subs at that point. You want to save them for later in the game.
Yeah, in hindsight, I would have put Boateng on for K at that time, put Buck back at the eight, and kind of played with two wingers, but I get why they didn't do that.
Right.
TSB11 on Discord says, if Carlos can't go next week, what lineup change gives the Revs the best chance to win?
Yeah, that makes, you know, it makes things a little more tough. I think you could, you know, like I was saying earlier, you could try, as the Revs have in the past under Bruce Arena, put Bo in that attacking midfield spot and roll with Wood and Vrioni up top in maybe a 4-4-2, you know, kind of revert back to that 2021 look with the 4-4-2 with the diamond midfield. You could try something like that. To be honest, the Revs have been shifting formations so often since PA arrived. I don't know that changing things up drastically is the way to go here. And I know that Carlos Seale's absence would necessitate that, but I think you'd have to find some sort of a balance where you simplify everyone's roles and you just try and get as much talent as you can on the field. And I don't know necessarily off the top of my head what that's going to look like, but I think that's the way you'd have to play it.
Yeah. If it's me, the first thought that comes to mind is what I was just suggesting, is having Boateng and Chanclay started as your wingers, having Buck and Polster as your center midfielders, and then play with two strikers, whether that's, you know, Bobby Wood and Gustavo Bo, or Giacomo Vrioni and Gustavo Bo. I think it's probably Wood and Bo. But I think that's one thought. I don't want to see them get too creative with formations and change up too much. I want to see them stick with the four-man back line. At the same time, you know, we've seen PA try a lot of different things. It wouldn't be that shocking to me if they went back to, you know, three center backs, and then use that as an opportunity to maybe have Boateng play as a left wing back and DeJuan Jones as your right wing back, something like that. And then, you know, you have your midfield three of, I guess you'd do, you know, Polster, Buck, and McNamara maybe, or you do Polster, Buck, and if you use like Chanclay as kind of a roaming attacking midfielder. And then depending on what you did there, you'd play either Chanclay up top with Bo, or you'd play Bo up top with another forward. But I think I think you should stick with the four-man back line and just kind of adjust your midfield and attack based on what you have.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think a four-man back line has really been the only defensive formation that seems to have worked under PA so far. And I know he's tried a three-man back line a few times, and I can understand why he would want to do that and what it unlocks for the Revs, especially without Brandon Bye. So getting, you know, having that extra center back in there should theoretically help. And then you can have, you know, wing backs that bomb up and down the field. I get that. But it really hasn't worked. And maybe to make a separate point about that formation change, you know, in three of the last four games, the Revs have conceded three goals in the first half. And then, of course, they've, I think, in each of those games conceded no goals in the second half. And in the first two of those instances, it came with, you know, a formation shift at halftime from PA. He made some subs, he made some changes. And I think, you know, maybe we were thinking after those two games, you know, he had adjusted the tactics, and those tactical adjustments were what made the difference between, you know, the Revs losing or only conceding three and maybe conceding more goals in the second half. And given how this game played out, I don't think he made any drastic changes, right? The Revs kept four-man back line in the second half of this game. It felt then to me, and it still felt like after last night's game, that it wasn't a tactical shift. It was more that, you know, the team they were playing against had a sizable lead and were at home and maybe took their foot off the gas a little bit. So I know this is kind of an aside, but I just wanted to maybe, you know, just talk a little bit about how I think PA's tactical adjustments were smart at the time, but also maybe not as impactful as we think.
Oh, I completely agree. I think that a lot of what changed in the second half was that Philly took their foot off the gas, and I think Jim Curtin wasn't completely happy with it when you could see all his reactions on the sideline and some of what was going on in the second half. But yeah, I mean, there were some good adjustments made for sure. I think bringing Boateng on was a good adjustment. You know, if you've listened to the podcast, how I feel about his lack of playing time at times this season, but you saw the impact he had when he came on the field. I think it was a little bit weird where he was playing in this game, but he still managed to have a good impact. So, yeah, I think his subs were generally good in the second half. It was more they weren't as much of a difference maker as what Philly did. But yeah, we'll see what happens in the next game. But I think it would be a mistake to make too many changes where they don't have to. In this one, that, you know, they should keep the same back line with the exception of maybe putting Kessler in for Farrell and adjust the areas where they actually need to adjust because Carlisle is out, if he's out.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Charles Maddox on Twitter, I think we weren't going to get away from a negative question about the referees after this game. He says, why does pro referees blatantly hate the Revolution? I could maybe understand one or two matches a season with bad calls or even no calls, but we are like five or six now. There needs to be a change.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I don't think this was a well-refed game by any stretch of the imagination. You know, the penalty kick it's a penalty, right? Like, I'm in the age of VAR where you can, you know, slow, you know, frame by frame down and see who touches the ball first. There's really no such thing as a 50-50 ball anymore. So that's, you know, that's the way that that's going to go. And then, of course, I think there was some concern about the third goal possibly being offside is what I'd seen. I personally think it was onside and at the very least too close to overturn. And, of course, people are, you know, upset about no yellow card on the challenge that would eventually knock Carlos Hill out of the game. I think that one probably has a little bit more traction. So I don't think this was a great ref game, but I don't think it was as bad as a lot of fans seem to think. And then, you know, the other comment I'd add is that, I don't know, I think most teams that perform poorly over the course of a season tend to think that the refs hate their team. And I don't know if that's just a, you know, a mentality thing where things are going poorly and you're looking for someone to blame, or if it's, you know, teams that perform poorly end up you know, doing things that require more referee attention or what it is. But, you know, I don't think this is a ref specific issue.
Yeah, so I'm with you. I think the controversies in this game were probably the yellow cards that were and weren't given. I think they were very inconsistent decisions on what was a yellow card in this game. That, I think, is a very legitimate gripe in this one. But, it was a penalty kick. I did not see an angle on that third goal that made me be comfortable definitively saying that whether that was offside. I don't know if there was one. I didn't see it. I think there was some people that have questioned whether the earlier chance from the revs that went off the crossbar actually crossed the line. The screen grabs that people showed certainly didn't definitively show it did.
Right. I've seen those screen grabs, and it seems like they paused it from an angle where the ball is like hasn't hit the ground yet, but it's like in the goal mouth. And like, I think if you pause the ball there anytime, it's going to look like it's in, right? Just from the angles that we have from a normal TV broadcast. So I didn't see anything there that seemed definitive that it would be a goal. And I think if I remember correctly, they showed a replay during the game that was closer to sideline, still not a perfect angle, but from that angle, it looked like it hadn't crossed to me.
Yeah, so for me, it seemed like they got the big decisions correct. It's right. Just the, you know, some of the fouls and yellow cards that you could argue about. And I don't think that changes the outcome of the game. I get why it's very frustrating. I think certainly the foul on Carlos Heel probably should have been a yellow card. I have seen fouls like that not get a yellow card before too, though. If Carlos Heel gets up and isn't injured, I don't think people are complaining about that as much. If it's me, I think it's a yellow card. But I don't think it was a well-refereed game, but I do think the major decisions that really impacted the game, they got right. I'm sure someone after this will tell me about some time where there should have been a second yellow card and someone should have been sent off because of missed yellow cards. I'm sure that was the case. Sure. But you can't say how a game plays out, you know, if there was a yellow card given earlier that, you know, the same foul happens or, you know, things like that. And I think there was it Rioni or somebody that committed a foul that, you know, the Revs could have had a second yellow card in that game. I think it might have been Rioni. I'm blanking on it. Or no, it was Chonkalai. Chonkalai almost got himself sent off in this one.
Yeah, he had three or four challenges that could have been, I don't know that they were clear-cut second yellows, but he was not shy about fouling players while he was on the yellow up there.
Yeah, so it could have been a lot worse. If Chonkalai leaves this game with a second yellow card and is suspended for game two and Carlos Heel is out, you might as well not even watch the game at that point.
Right. So I have a question for you. Maybe you don't. Do you know what the playoff format is for yellow card accumulation? Is there any yellow card accumulation that would need to be a concern here?
That is a great question that I do not know the answer to. I'm sure there is some yellow card accumulation in the playoff situation. There has to be. Whether that's two or three, I don't know the answer to that. But yeah, that's a very good question. If I can figure that out after the show, I'll tweet it out. But I don't know the answer to that one off the top of my head.
Sorry, I didn't mean to spring that one on you.
No, it's a good question. I should have been on top of that one. Walk on Twitter says this Revs team has been quite the group of nice guys in these several years. You need to manage to do some more damage to opponent's player if they manage to injure Carles Heel. Ure has been managing minutes with his knee. Gazzag has issues with his meniscus in early September. Mild Bill Davidson on Twitter says if Carles isn't fit to play the next game, someone needs to take Ure out. I'd rather the Revs play a man down. And then he has some expletives that I'm not going to read. Do you think the Revs need to be, I don't know if more dirty is the word, or, you know, more physical and kind of get revenge for what happened to Carles?
No, I don't. I mean, listen, if what we're talking about here is targeting players and trying to injure them and take them out of the field, that's not something I'm going to get behind, and not something I'm going to touch with a 10-foot pole. And I don't think the Reds should either. I think there's an argument that can be made that they should be playing a little bit more physically and a little bit more aggressively. But if that, you know, comes with the idea of specifically targeting players to, you know, to go in hard challenges, I don't think that's the way to go about doing it. But Philly does, you know, they have, and, you know, always have under Jim Curtin, as long back as I can remember, play, you know, fairly physical soccer. So that is something that you maybe need to match if you want results to go your way, right? Like you need to be not just ready to absorb that physicality, but I think, you know, you could make an argument that they could play more physical and that would benefit their play style. But no, don't target players.
Yeah, so I agree with all that. I think, you know, Revs being more physical, that is something they should probably do. But I think when you go into a game kind of thinking about targeting somebody or being more physical, your head is not, or not necessarily being more physical, but targeting players being more dirty, your head is not in the right space. You could end up getting a red card and you could not be focusing on the things that actually matter. So I get the frustration with what happened in this game. You know, it was a bad foul on Carles Heel. I don't know that I'd necessarily call it dirty. You know, it was just a hard foul, and you see that all the time. And unfortunate that it led to an injury, but yeah, we'll see. We'll see what they do in the next game, but I certainly wouldn't go about targeting anybody. Evan Ryan on Twitter says, when are we going to address the elephant in the room and discuss the lack of effort the Revs have shown all year? Even going back to during the Bruce era of the season, this team doesn't have the heart to win that the team from 21, or he said the heart, sorry, I might be misreading this. He says the team from 21 is dead.
Well, all right, so I'll address the last part first. And I think, yeah, I think the team from 21 is dead. But I don't think that that's I think he's attributing it to a lack of effort. I have this game on, I'm watching it on silent in the background here while we're recording this podcast. And like, I'm in the middle of watching Andrew Farrell, like put his body on the line to clear the ball with his head and, you know, getting nailed in the process. Like, I don't think that this is an effort thing, but I do think that the tactics of this team have changed since 2021, right? There is much less of an impetus to, you know, throw numbers forward to sprint and catch teams in bad positions in that way. And we've been much more, even since the beginning of this year, a team that wants to, you know, build from the back. They want to pass the ball side to side. They want to unlock teams, you know, with the ball. And I think because of that, it tends to be a little bit more slow and methodical than it had been in 2021. And I think maybe that's what makes this look like the Revs are putting in lower effort. I forget who it is. I think maybe it's Opta. Opta has a stats website where they will show you on a graph what your style of play is. And I can't remember the exact name of the web address, so I apologize. But if you look at that, the Revs have a more methodical buildup type strategy than they have in the past. So I think maybe that's what's causing, you know, maybe it to look like they're playing with lower effort, but, you know, I'm not seeing that on the field. I'm seeing players who maybe, you know, maybe defensively are giving up on plays or appear to. But I think we saw that in years past. And I think we see that with every team. You know, every team has individuals that, you know, we'll look like they're quitting on a play, or we'll look like they're making the wrong decision. So I think that the premise might be a little bit flawed. I think that the Revs are, you know, down a lot of players, playing with a play style that doesn't emphasize, you know, direct sprinting attack. And I can understand why that maybe seems like it's low effort, but I'm not seeing it.
Yeah. I think if there's any kind of justification to our thing that would lead you to believe this is more the defensive side of the ball, where you see guys that aren't necessarily tracking runners all the time and, you know, missing opportunities to, you know, get in front of somebody for a header or things like that. But I don't think that's new. I think it's just more exaggerated and obvious when you don't have your, you know, world-class goalkeeper behind them to kind of bail them out, or when you have guys out injured like Brandon Bae. But I do think there's been plenty of times this season where you've been frustrated watching a goal on replay and saying, well, why didn't this guy track that runner? And that might lead you to think lack of effort. But yeah, I don't think anything's necessarily changed on that front from what we saw before. It's just when things are going poorly, these things are more noticeable. And I appreciate you giving a long answer here, because it gave me time to look up what the yellow card accumulation is, and it's 3 yellow cards. So therefore, you don't really have to worry about it till the next round, because you're not getting 3 yellow cards in 2 games unless you're getting a red card anyways. So
right. Okay, I'm glad you found that, because I am also frantically Googling where in the rules to find that accumulation. Yeah, so I'm glad that we both have the same idea.
So 3 yellow cards, and it doesn't carry over to the conference championship. I think that's getting way ahead of ourselves, but it really, the opportunity to get three yellow cards, I think you basically have to get three yellow cards in these three games, right? Because you, yeah, right?
It's, I would assume so, right?
Yeah, because if you don't get three yellow cards in these three games, you're good. So just get avoid getting a yellow card one of the three games, and you should avoid a suspension, I think.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So that, you know, that also, you know, that feeds into the refereeing bit that we were talking about earlier, right? So, if, you know, it would be a bigger deal if you needed fewer yellow cards because the ref was handing out yellows to the Rebs. I think deservedly so for a lot of challenges in this one. But, you know, that would change the calculus if they needed fewer before a suspension was inbound.
Yeah, it's good to know that there's no, if they do make it to game three, there's no way a player is going to be suspended for yellow card accumulation. They're only going to be suspended for getting a red card.
Right.
Helpful. So Real OTD on Threads said, I turned it off after the third goal. My question is, why specifically should I be optimistic about next year? I know we'll have more consistency with PA, but I can't think of a reason to be excited about next year.
So the optimism for next year kind of spans from what we don't know. I think we are fairly confident, I would feel fairly confident in saying that Clint PA is probably not your head coach next year. Things would have to take a real dramatic turn here, and the Reds would basically have to win out, you know, through MLS Cup for that to be, I think, a consideration. You know, we've heard from Tom Bogert, and we've also, I think, heard from Brian Bilillo that they are actively looking, you know, to make some changes, both at sporting director and at head coach. So, you know, the optimism, I think, probably has to stem from the fact that, you know, whoever is going to be in charge next year, you know, is going to be different from what we have now, which doesn't seem to be working. Or it hasn't been, you know, over the last month or so. So I think that's the optimism, right? You know, without knowing who's going to be the sporting director, which I think is their plan to hire sporting director first, you know, without knowing who that's going to be, you know, it's hard to know who the head coach will be. And without knowing who the head coach will be, it's hard to know which players are going to be, you know, kept around and which ones might be traded or loaned or cut or what have you. So it's, you know, it's a lot of unknowns at this time. But, you know, there is, I would be surprised if whoever the new coach is willing to dump a lot of the talent that we have on this team, right? Carlos Heel, I think, is under contract through next year, or is under team control on his contract next year. You know, Sean Kalai, I would be surprised if they didn't exercise the option to keep him around. He's looked very, very good for the Revs. So I think he's, you know, another player that you could reasonably say is hopefully going to stick around. You know, Barrero will be coming back healthy. That's, you know, a very strong attack. And then you can build off that, right? So I think your optimism stems from the fact that you have good pieces and, you know, whatever the coaching situation is next year, you know, maybe it's better than what we have now.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. There's two reasons to be optimistic. One is that we should have Dylan Barrero back next year. It should be Chonkley should be back next year. Carlos Heel should be back next year. And then you have one of the most dangerous looking attacking midfield trios that I can think of in the league, if all those guys are healthy and in shape. So that's certainly a reason to be excited. And hopefully they figure out what forward plays in front of them, because Gustavo Bo may or may not be here, and Rioni hasn't lived up to the hype, and you know, Bobby Wood is Bobby Wood. So, you know, but just having those three guys is a reason to be optimistic. And then the other part is the unknown, and that optimism goes away as soon as they make underwhelming signings at coach and sporting director. So as long as we don't know who it is, there's reason to be optimistic, and hopefully they make signings that continue the optimism. But as soon as you hear those signings names, if they're not guys that make you excited, a lot of that optimism goes away. So,
right. Those are the two reasons. Now is your chance to be optimistic.
Yes, exactly. And hope that they give you reason to stay optimistic. but yeah, a lot of it is all about the unknown. All right. We got a lengthy question on Discord. I don't think I'm going to read the whole thing, but I'll try to sum it up as best as I can. And also I apologize in advance for potentially botching the name. Xinyu Tian on Discord says, this is a very long thread slash question. I have noticed for a while that roughly since Clint Pied took over, there is an extreme lack of protection in front of the center backs during transitional slash pullback moments. Many of the times, the 2 to 3 center backs are standing there facing the opposition attacker to annihilate them. There's been some blame on Marc-Anthony Kay's lack of ability to track back. It's also come to my attention that the issue on Noel Buck has been going hugely under the radar. 9 goals conceded since Clint Pied took charge when having Buck on the field before today's game. He goes on to list all of those goals and manages to place some blame on Buck on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of those 9 goals. 5 of those 9 goals. And then he says, well, the exact instruction on Buck from the coaching staff is unclear. He is mostly playing as a duo, sitting 6 or some hybrid 6-8 that takes some progressive carry and passing ability. Playing this position needs a lot of tracking back and protecting the center backs, and I just don't think he is doing any good of that at the moment. There's been many moments that Buck was far away when some transitional happened, and he didn't even make the way into the screen in the end. So a lot there, but I guess the main focus is here is kind of Noel Buck and maybe his lack of tracking and getting back. And I guess any thoughts on that? Have you noticed that?
So I don't know that I that's something I've noticed specifically. I also tend to think that Buck is probably either by instruction or just by virtue of what they ask him to do in the attack, he's not as involved in the defense or in defense in transition. And you know, is that a place that he can maybe improve? Yeah, sure. I think everybody can probably stand to improve defensively, especially when the Revs have been conceding goals the way that they have. But you know, I think I view him on the pitches, you know, less of a 6 defensive holding type midfielder and more of one who's been asked to carry the ball into the attack and work it out wide. You know, we saw him play on the wings, I think in this game a little bit. And you know, I think that's more his spot on the field. So I'm less likely to really dig deep on his defensive misgivings. I didn't read through. I did see this comment, but I didn't read through all the specific examples. But I think there's also a lot. There's a lot of blame that can be passed around to lots of different players. So I'm not sure why. Buck is being singled out for that specifically, considering I usually see him as a player that I would expect less defensive work rate from, anyways.
Yeah, so I have noticed it in some situations. Certainly, we can point out that goal that was given up on the free kick, the third goal in this one, where he didn't track his runner. I don't know if that was because he was trying to hold the high line or what happened there. But with that said, I agree with what you're saying, Andy. And when I look at Noel Buck's season this year, I think he was at his absolute best when he was in games playing right next to Matt Polster, because the two of them had a lot of great chemistry. He knew when to go forward. He knew when to stay back when Polster was going to go forward. They played really, really well together. And then you added Ian Harkes to the equation. You added Marc-Anthony Kay, and the two of them really didn't get paired much together after that. And we've been seeing Buck kind of play more of an attacking role, either on the wing or somewhere in the middle or kind of all over the place. I don't think that necessarily brings out his best qualities the way it did when he was playing as kind of an 8 next to Matt Polster, and the two of them, had that chemistry and could read each other and knew when to make runs and when to stay back. We just haven't seen that as much. So I think some of this falls on the coaching staff and what role they've been asking Noel Buck to play. But I do think it's maybe a little bit harsh to single him out, because there's a lot of guys that you could single out for, not tracking runners and not tracking back. But if in my view, if it was up to me, and if Carles Hill is out especially, I would like to see Noel Buck paired with Polster again in that more defined role where the two of them can play off of each other, because I do think that is where Noel Buck is at its best. It's just the fact the Revolution have added so many other central midfielders with Kay and Harkes, now McNamara back from being healthy, that it seems like they're trying to find Buck other roles to play instead of that role, which I think is his best role. And if he was playing that role, I'd be more concerned if he wasn't tracking back. But I think when he was playing that role, he was doing a better job of that.
Right. I don't want to single this person out for the question too much, but like in the premise of the question also, right, he talks about how, since Clint Pied took over and in games where Buck is on the field and they've conceded this many goals. But I think if we look at it that way kind of in a vacuum, I think you can make the argument he's making, you know, but in the premise of the question is since Clint PA took over, right? So there's one big change, you know, right around the time that Clint PA took over, right? We had Mark Anthony Kay come into the lineup, and he mentions Mark Anthony Kay specifically in the question as someone that people are looking at to blame for these types of goals. And then, you know, Brandon Bye's injury also kind of coincides with that. And Georgia Petrovic, his sale almost coincides, you know, with all of that kind of going down. So, you know, I can understand looking at Buck. But, you know, when there's four or five different factors that kind of all change all at once. And, you know, these are goals that are being given up in transition when the team, you know, theoretically there should be, you know, more than one person covering in defense. I have a hard time, you know, pinning the blame just on Buck.
Yeah, and my biggest disagreement with the question is that I don't think he's been playing much as a six or even a hybrid 6-8 since PA's taken over. So I think that's where kind of my disagreement comes from. All right, we've got a few questions left, not much. All of them are about who should be fired. So we'll go through these and I guess kind of get your thoughts. But I guess I'll read all of them now, and then we can kind of take them individually. But DC on Twitter says, "How does Brian Blow still have a job? We need to ask ourselves, has the past 19 years been successful, and is his MLS 1.0 vision still feasible? Something has to change, and Brian has to be switched I'm struggling to read this one. Brian has to be switched. A shakeup happened. I think it was mistranslated as shackle, but a shakeup happened in coaching 3 years ago. Now we need the FO shakeup. Please address this." Eric Bullock on Discord says, "Who would you fire right now?" is my question. I guess I think Clinton's done, but at this point, would you just throw Bolello and Kurt out with him, right? And then Porter on Discord says, "Given how the Revs are about to go out of the playoffs without a playoff win since 2020, who is most at fault? Brian Bolello for entrusting the entire sporting operation, Bruce Arena for his hot and cold signings in the notable sporting decisions like not having a Tejan replacement ready to go and signing Ben Sweat when the Revolution needed a backup right back, or Kurt Nofo and ownership for signing Petrovic without having another capable goalkeeper ready to go." So a lot there. I guess maybe do we want to start with the second one, which kind of ties in all the others, is, you know, who is going to be fired? Is Clint PA gone at the end of the season? And is Brian Bolello and Kurt Nofel also gone at the end of the season?
Yeah. So I think I mentioned earlier, right? I think that PA, unless things have a dramatic turn here, I think he's probably on the chopping block. And I honestly don't think that he was, you know, brought in to be the long-term solution, right? I think he was kind of, you know, a replacement. You know, I think Bolello mentions that he, you know, the team was kind of reacting to the news as it was happening to them, and, you know, so they put him in there just for some basic level of continuity. And, you know, I think the idea there was probably that he, you know, if things went super well, then, you know, he could earn his way into the full-time job. But, you know, I don't think things have gone well enough to say that that's happening. So I think that's, you know, right off the bat, I think that's probably the easy one if you're looking for someone to fire. And I don't know that we should be framing it that way, but I think, you know, he's the most obvious one to go.
I think with him too, it's less about necessarily firing him. If he's willing to go back to being the Revs 2 head coach, I think that's fine.
Oh, absolutely.
It's, you know, I would be shocked, and I think it'd be a big mistake to keep him on as the first team head coach, barring them making, you know, a run to MLS Cup at this point.
Right. And I mean, I don't know, to be honest, even if the Revs did make a run to MLS Cup at this point, it would have to be like, things would have to look almost completely different for me to think that that was probably the right move. You know, playoffs are kind of fluky, right? So
right. If they make a run to MLS Cup and it's a bunch of draws that go to shutouts, to go to shootouts, right? Then it's different.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And then in terms of the other two, Anolfo is a tough one. I mean, I think we've kind of already heard from Bolello that they're looking for a sporting director. So I think that's the role that Anolfo is currently in. So it seems like he's probably on his way out. I actually, you know, I don't have a big issue with what Anolfo's done. I think he's done a great job building out the academy. I think he's done a great job with Revs 2 and getting the most out of that setup. You know, the Revs 2 were, I think, in the Eastern Conference Finals this year. and it looked pretty good over the course of the year. And then, of course, the academy teams, you know, they, I think it was the, with the under 17s, won the MLS Next Cup. So that's their second year in a row doing that. So, you know, we've seen definite strides from that perspective under Anolfo's watch. So, you know, I'm less into the idea of firing him, but I think from a sporting director's side, from the first team perspective, I can understand wanting to make kind of a clean break and get just some new blood in. And then, I've seen this this comment on Brian Bolello throughout the course of the season. It always seems to come up after the Revs lose a game, and I always think that Brian Bolello had almost nothing to do with the Revs losing that game. So, you know, from what I understand of his role, and maybe, you know, and maybe I'm wrong about this. He can correct me if he's listening or whatever. He wants to correct me on this somewhere on Twitter or whatever. But I don't think that he's super involved in the day-to-day tactical decisions that take place. I don't think he's involved in, you know, really in any sort of depth in terms of player signings, in terms of, you know, player contracts, anything like that. I think that all falls to the sporting director. I think his involvement is he's involved in the process by which the Revs hire a sporting director and a head coach. And I think he's involved in kind of the off the field, all the off the field stuff that the Revs are involved in. Right. And, you know, you could say that's, you know, his involvement in trying to get a stadium for the Revs in the city. You could say that's, you know, increasing the awareness of the team in the area. And, you know, I think you can make an argument that he hasn't done like the best job at those things, but I don't think that has anything to do with how the Revs are playing on the field. So I'm not sure that anything I've seen from a soccer standpoint indicates that Bolello should go anywhere.
Yeah, I agree. And you look at kind of the tough part with Bolello is he's got the president title, and some people think it means more than it does, right? He's not involved in the on-field decisions. He's certainly not involved in the tactics. He's not involved in player signings. He is involved in some ways in hiring the people at the top of those decisions, which you can't ignore. And I think he did prior to this season, he did a good job getting Bruce Arena in and putting him in charge of all that. It all went south this year, but I think that was a good move by him. Where he is in charge is a lot of the off-the-field stuff. He sits at the top of those decisions. And, you know, from what we're told, season ticket renewals are up next year. Attendance is doing really well this season. So with all that in mind, I think from, you know, the Kraft's perspective, he's doing a good job in his role. There's certainly individual things you can gripe about. There's, you know, marketing decisions that you don't know how much of, you know, again, he's at the top of that, but you don't know how much of his hand he had in that you may not be happy with. But as far as the on-field stuff goes, you know, beyond being involved in hiring the coach and hiring the sporting director, he's, you know, his involvement, I think, is very limited or none. So I don't know that it changes very much. Now, on the other hand, if they, you know, make a very underwhelming signing and sporting director this year, and make a very underwhelming coach signing this year, and they don't pan out, then maybe we revisit this. But
sure.
I think he did a good job hiring Bruce Arena, and it's unfortunate it unraveled the way it did this year. But as far as his, you know, on-field hires, the recent ones were good up until disaster struck.
Right. So I also think that he's not like a sole decision maker in terms of sporting director and head coach, right? I think ownership is certainly involved in that process. And there must either be other people in the front office who are involved in that as well. So he's involved in those processes, but I don't think that he's the one making the final call anyways. But yeah, I think from a pure on-field sports product kind of perspective, I think Bruce Arena, I think most people would say it was a pretty good coaching hire. You know, things have definitely not gone of a way that we would all have liked and hoped in the last couple months, of course. But I don't think that's something you can pin on Brian.
So I guess the last part here is Porter's question of who do we blame the most? Brian Bolello for entrusting everything to Bruce for his questionable signings. I think there's a lot of other things too. Or Kurt Anolfo for selling Petrovic along with ownership without another goalkeeper ready to go.
if we're picking one of those three, I think, you know, Bruce is probably the one who had the most impact on, you know, the roster and of course his own absence from the team. Right. So I think, I think if we're picking one of those three to blame, I think if we look back on it, there's been a lot of, a lot of his personnel decisions were, maybe a little questionable in terms of who he decided to bring into the team and who he decided not to bring in positions he decided to emphasize and other positions he decided not to. And I think that's kind of left the team, kind of here to pick up the pieces of someone else's vision. And I think that that's always going to be hard. So I think if we're placing blame, it's probably there.
Yeah. Easy answer, but it's the right answer, I think.
Right. I can also understand, I know we just watched a game where Jacob Jackson, committed a goalkeeping error that led to the other team scoring their first goal. And I can understand that there's that will make you think, oh, we should have kept Petrovic. I still don't believe that that was a realistic expectation to keep Petrovic, given the size of the offer and given what we knew about, how he had interacted with the previous set of offers. So, I know plenty of people on Twitter think that there was some sort of magic that could have been worked to keep him. I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, so I agree with everything. I think Bruce Arena certainly is the one that gets the most blame out of this list of people. I don't know how you can pin it on anyone else. Certainly some blame, but the vast majority has to go to Bruce Arena for, like was mentioned in this, some of his bad signings, the fact that they didn't bring in a right back and signed Ben Sweat instead. That was a terrible signing, just one on a longer list of kind of mistakes. He's also made some good signings too, for sure. But, at the end of the day, it was him that, let whatever happened, and got himself kind of ousted from the team. It was also him that didn't seem to resolve some clashes between his assistant coaches that, made it even more of a problem when he was gone. So there's a lot of, I don't want to, relitigate everything we've talked about in the past, but I think that's, the obvious choice is Bruce Arena. And I 100% agree with you. Once the Revs got that offer for Petrovic, there was no turning back. And, Brian Bielalba said the same thing, and I don't think he's lying. It was too much for them to refuse. Petrovic, his head was probably gone at that point when he had an offer from a great team to join them for a lot of money, to both salary-wise and transfer fee-wise. There wasn't an option there. And with that said, Cardenolfo does deserve some blame for signing Vasilic and apparently not having a good sense of where his fitness was at. So that is where he gets blame. I do think he was in a very tough position where he didn't have a lot of time to make a move and get a replacement goalkeeper. We've talked before about Josh Cohen and how Atlanta wouldn't give up his rights. And that made things more complicated. But certainly there is some blame for the fact that they tried to bring in a replacement goalkeeper and he wasn't ready to play the season.
Yeah, right. He obviously deserves some blame for how the Vasilic situation has turned out, right? You would expect, a goalkeeper with his pedigree, even if he hadn't been playing for a while, to be able to at least make the bench, right? As a goalkeeper, I would assume on not a ton of weeks of training, So the fact that he's not there yet, I think, you can place some blame at Anolfo's feet if you want to. But I also think, like you mentioned, he was kind of in a tough spot, right? He was trying to sign a goalkeeper from a list of, only free agents. And right, that kind of makes things a little more difficult. And, of course, there was the whole, situation with Atlanta and Cohen. So, I think you can blame him, but I also think he was put in a real tough position to begin with.
Yeah, and that's it for questions. Steve McGrugan on Twitter, I want to give him a shout out. He said, you gents are too good to ask a question after this game. I won't subject you to that. So thanks, Steve.
Appreciate it.
With that, Andy, any final thoughts? Anything that we missed?
No, I mean, I think my only final thought would be if, we have a 10-day window or a 10-day gap here between the next, or between last night and the next game, and it's a midweek game, and we are all kind of bummed about that, being in the middle of the week, but I will be there cheering the team on, and I hope a bunch of other people make the same decision, even though it's kind of a, it'll almost certainly be a cold, rainy day in the middle of a week on, in November or whatever it'll be, so. I'm excited to get one last home game out of the season, and I hope everybody else shows up.
And I guess before we finish, where can people find your writing, and do you have anything up now that people should check out or anything upcoming in the following couple weeks that people should be looking for?
Sure. Yeah, you guys can check out my work. I write for Boston Sports Nation. That's bossportsnation.com. You can find all my articles and content there under the Revolution tab. I'm currently the only Revs writer there, so you'll be able to find my stuff pretty easily. I tend to focus, you know, a little more on the stats heavy, numbers heavy stuff. So if that's stuff that appeals to you, then certainly give my stuff a look. I am trying to mix it up a little bit. Last week, you know, I did a whole article that had no charts at all, which as difficult as that was for me to do, it was a narratives focused piece heading into the playoffs. So you guys can check that out, you know, and all the stats stuff over at Boston Sports Nation. In terms of what's upcoming, I do have a few ideas in the works. And then for whenever the season ends, I am going to try to put together, as I did last year, a big kind of statistical breakdown of the season. So that'll be a big one that'll come out whenever the season does end for the Revs.
Be sure to check all that out, and be sure to follow Andy on Twitter at Andy Revs Nation, or X, whatever we call it these days. Can follow me on Twitter at Sean L. Donahue, and of course, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Revolution Recap. Also, please rate and review us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to podcasts, and be sure to check out our friends at The Blazing Musket. Thanks again for listening to Revolution Recap, presented by Bet Online. We'll be back after the playoff game, at the next playoff game, with another podcast.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.